I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, it's 10 years since the iconic 2012 Olympic Games in London, and it's why I'm delighted to welcome one of our greatest ever Olympians, who many see as one of the trailblazers that paved the way for the Olympians of today. Duncan Goodhue scored gold in the 100-meter breaststroke in the 1980 Moscow Olympics in a dramatic, nail-biting finish that went down to the wire. It marked a remarkable transformation for a young man who described himself as drowning during his time at school, struggling with the challenges of dyslexia. But in a story of resilience and ambition, Duncan overcame the odds to become one of the most iconic British sporting figures of the 20th century and lives by the motto, you're only as good as your worst day. Duncan, welcome to Changemakers.
Hi, that's a hard thing to live up to now, Michael. You really set the bar.
Yeah, you've had the intro. You've had the gold medal intro, Duncan. Yeah. That's... Let's start with you're only as good as your worst day. You and I have spoken about that motto before. Explain it to listeners.
Yeah, it came out of a training, I suppose. Swimming training is particularly onerous because you've got two long sessions a day plus weights and stretching. I suppose there were some days I'd do 800 lengths, which is quite a lot of lengths. And if you start counting the tiles, then you get really bored. So yeah. I suppose I had an epiphany at some point or other and realized that my dream of going to the Olympic Games was basically 1 minute every 4 years.
That's an amazing way of putting it.
Yeah, the accuracy involved in performance on that, and some other bugger picked it as well. Yeah. So it wasn't even the minute you picked. It then got me thinking of if I can't have a bad day because I can't have a bad hour because I can't have a bad minute in 4 years, then you're only as good as your worst day. That I couldn't control the minutes that I was going to swim.
Before we go into how you do make your worst day your best day, let's just dwell for a minute. I mean, 800 lengths a day.
Wasn't every day. Hardest days, I should say.
Well, it puts my 50 lengths twice a week into perspective. But I mean, it's sort of like thinking about that and thinking about that you get that moment just once every 4 years. In terms of the pressure for an elite athlete, you and the people you know, in terms of getting it right, I mean, how does the anxiety work in terms of the build-up to these major global events, in terms of knowing, I've just got to get it right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first time I went to the Olympic Games was in 76 Montreal Olympic Games. And I always remember my mother saying, I phoned up my mother and said, I was 18, or 19 when I got to the Olympics, but when I phoned her up, I was 18. And I said, have you booked your tickets to the Olympic Games? And she said, no. And I said, why not? She said, well, they haven't picked the team. And I was no one from nowhere at this point, but tracking really, really well. And I said to her, I said, Mum, it's not a question of whether I'm going or not. It's which medal I'm going to win. And she said, don't be so cocky. And she didn't pick the, she didn't buy the tickets, and she couldn't get the tickets, and she didn't go. So it's a great shame.
But I read that when you were preparing for Montreal, you asked yourself two questions. Who, me? I spill soup down my tire, trip over my shoelaces. And the next was, why me out of nearly 8 billion people in the world? I mean, in terms of that sort of, I suppose, the answering in the affirmative, how do you mentally prepare for like these moments, which are just, you know, must be an absolute pressure cauldron of emotions and of ideas flying around in your own mind that none of the rest of us see on the TV?
Well, I think it's about controlling your biology and your mind. And your biology, I suppose, is comes back from hunter-gatherers, that it's a good idea to turn up on the prey at the same time or just behind everybody else so you don't get eaten or hurt.
Right.
So I think, it's amazing how you tend to slow down when you're ahead. And in a sense, the other point you get is if anything's new, it feels odd. If it feels odd, then you slow down. And in the Olympic Games, when you got billions of people watching and it's your first time up, as it were, it does feel new and it does feel odd. And so the temptation is for the biology to do the speaking rather than you do the speaking. And then you slow down. So that's the biology side. And the mental side is, you know, how much of a screwball are you? Do you really believe that you are the best in the world? You know, there are 8 billion people on the planet and you're the one. And I suppose you've got to work physically to counterbalance the biology. And then psychologically, you have to work to support that. And that's about understanding what you're doing and working on it. So I use visualization. I watch myself swim. I perfected everything on how you did it. So when I got there, it was almost a foregone conclusion.
Right. So let's frame this in terms of advice to listeners, because the thing I'm thinking about is that I guess on the biology side, you'll be alongside other swimmers that have got, you know, fantastic sort of ability. And then there is the kind of, I suppose, the attitudinal side, which is the kind of what you're telling yourself in terms of the inner narrative. And then I suppose it's, well, what do you do on the day to actually do, to deliver on what you speak about, which is making sure that your worst day is not your worst day, but happens to become your best day. I mean, is there a tip? Is there an advice piece that you give to listeners in terms of, well, how might I do that? What's the, I mean, you mentioned visualization. What's something they could, that people could do?
Well, I mean, first of all, I normalize it as much as possible. And so it becomes normal. It becomes like, you know, shaving or brushing your hair, which I don't do anything like that. but it's just something you get out of bed and do. So it's normalizing it, first of all. And then, you know, in terms of probability, it's actually proving it to yourself and everybody around you. So I did certain things that I made sure I swam faster than everybody else in every race. And so not only was I training hard and coming back to the worst day, it was very simple. I was sitting at breakfast one day and I'd just been made captain of the swim team. And I was looking around and, you know, some people were having good breakfast, some swimmers were not. I kind of said, what's going on here? And it came really obvious that the swimmers who were having a good breakfast had a good workout, and the ones that weren't having a good breakfast had a bad workout. So I looked at that cohort, and all of them had other things going on in their lives. So, you know, they were having problems with their partners, or, you know, have trouble with the university, whatever it was.
So distracted, in other words.
And I thought, that's really interesting. So there's a connect between your physical performance and your psychological conditions of things spilling into the water. And I thought, well, if that's happening to them, it's happening to me. And I started to monitor it, and sure enough, it was starting to happen to me. And so I made a rule to work my hardest on my worst days. And very quickly I found out on my worst days most of it was psychological, and by halfway through the workout I'd broken through, and I had such an elation from breaking through that my worst days became better than some of my best days. Now, if you're a mathematician and you work out how that impacts on the average, and the numbers they affect the numbers incredible. Your average suddenly goes up because you've cut the worst out and you've kept the best.
I love though the personal opportunity to not accept your worst day or a bad day as just something that is therefore going to overwhelm you in a very negative sense, but actually you can take control. And I suppose, you know, you're a very good example of that in a physical environment, in a swimming pool, but I guess people could do that in their places of work, in relationships, and in everything. But
there's a really other important point in that is it's also your best days. You don't try and work, you just enjoy it.
You just do it. Yeah.
You just do it. And so what you do is God comes back into it. Rather than really caning yourself on the good days, you just relax and let it happen. And when you relax and let it happen, guess what?
It happens.
You're not forcing it.
Well, let's go from a worst day to a really great day, because one of the reasons we're speaking is because we're speaking on the anniversary of the 2012 London Olympics.
Fantastic.
You were an amazing, I mean, we'll get into that, but I mean, just to frame it, I mean, you're one of the seven legends of the games that kicked it off, one of the ambassadors. As the ambassador for Team GB, a torchbearer, deputy mayor for the Olympic Village. I mean, you were not just there to watch the games, but you were integrally involved in it, Duncan. I mean, and of course, I also think for those of us that were watching, it was one of the moments that was spine-tinglingly good. It felt good. It was a feel-good experience, not just for sport, of which it was undoubtedly that, but it felt much more important society-wide in terms of everything, in terms of the way we felt about the nation, the way that we felt about togetherness, the way that we felt about really just some incredible spectacle that almost caught us off guard. You know, it was an amazing moment. What was it like the other side of that?
Oh, it's just everything was just quite extraordinary. There's so many stories I could tell you. We could talk for hours on it. And fascinating stories. I think that I've always, I swam for Great Britain because I love the country. I have immense belief in what's possible for this country and everything. And I suppose the Olympic Games at 2012 exactly showed what we were capable of. Mm. And even today, when we look back at it, it wasn't what we did better. It was how much better did we do than any other games at everything. Mm. And there's just countless stories about how we performed as a nation on design. From, for instance, nobody got killed in the whole construction of the Olympic Games and all the infrastructure. That's never happened.
As you say, that's a normal occurrence, is it? People die in
People die in constructions and things like that. It didn't happen, and it hasn't happened since. And then you looked at, for instance, in my sport, we used to spend, say, 3 to 4 hours on a bus being passed between venues prior to our events, getting the training we needed because you couldn't all get in the Olympic facility. There were too many swimmers to be able to do that. Mm. Just a couple of minutes walk from the back of the Olympic Village were, I think it was 8 Olympic-sized temporary swimming pools that were open 24 hours a day. You didn't have to book a lane. You just wandered down for a swim. Never happened since and never happened before. It was all the detail that you couldn't believe. To temporary stadiums, they'd never done temporary stadiums before. You know, that incredible beach volleyball at Horse Guards where, you know, Henry VIII used to do.
I went to watch it. It was amazing.
I bet Henry VIII would have enjoyed it too.
Yes, I think he might have. I mean, but when you compare, like, here we are 10 years later, I mean 2022 feels like a much gloomier year, I think, in many ways. In terms of, I suppose, the lessons of 2012 that you take out, the things that we should, you know, fight hard not to forget, to keep hold of, what are the attitudes? What are the sort of the soft, more intangible things, I think, that you'd say we should fight hard for right now?
Well, I think that we have a uniqueness in this country. We really do. And when you look at 2012, the amount of volunteers and how they responded, the way that everybody went the extra mile for other people to make it happen, and the understanding of how important it was. And I suppose the biggest thing that I'd take away was, for instance, the loudest decibel in the stadium was in the Olympic, big Olympic stadium. It wasn't the Bolt final of the 100 metres. It was the Peacock final of the 100 metres. And why was it so loud? Well, it was a British crowd watching a British athlete overcoming, you know, all the challenges and winning. And that bit of Britain that is there, it hasn't gone. It's still there. And you see it time and time again throughout the country. And unfortunately, the news on the 24/7 now is almost making it
is gloomy. I mean, to your point, I mean, I remember interviewing you at the Made Festival in Sheffield, and it was a marvelous. I don't know if you met 3,000 people in the City Hall, and you brought your gold medal along with you. And I mean, to spare your blushes, I can remember you took it out to show it to the audience, and the response was incredible. I mean, the cheering, the sort of, I mean, just the symbolism of that gold medal is so important to us, isn't it? It's almost like a spiritual thing, isn't it, in terms of the effect of sport on people and their their self-belief and their sense of identity?
I just don't get it. I swam too late, the taps and back, and I made it. Surprise, surprise. You know, I think it's exactly that. It's an arbitrary distance. It's physical. Everybody understands it, you know, and it's visceral. And, you know, you look at it and go, that's easy, but it's not.
Yeah.
And it brings back, you know, who we are. We're hunter-gatherers. We love to chase things. Then we love to catch them. And then we cook them. Then we, you know, preen ourselves. And then we dance. You know, we are this, you know, we are a creature, the most extraordinary, incredibly successful creature. I mean, there are 8 billion of us.
But I love the modesty. And often you get that when you interview a lot of people that are really, really good at something. And they just assume that that's normal, you know, but actually, but I mean, you did something incredible. And I mean, let's get in our time machine and let's go back to the 22nd of July, 1980, 42 years ago, because that was the moment you were preparing to get in that swimming pool and do something incredible. I mean, let's talk about, I suppose, the before, middle and after in terms of Duncan arriving. Let's remember, 1980, Soviet Union, very different environment and era. And you're there with a job to do. Pick up the story for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, before I went, my stepfather was Air Vice Marshal, DSO Divot at sea, bar twice. He was a war hero. Shot down 22 and a half aeroplanes. He didn't want me to go and was adamant about it. My mother went and my stepfather didn't. The press were completely against us going, and I had to fight to help justify us going to Moscow. So that was before I got there. When we got there, it was tense, and I went through the, you know, heats and everything fine and got to the final. Before you go into the final, there's a little cool room. You're called up and you have this little room. And 4 years before, that's when I had a moment, and it was lamb to a slaughter there. And I said, who me, why me, in the middle of the waiting for it, and it all went downhill after that. This time I was ready, really, really prepared. You know, we've talked about the visualization, gone through all that. And I went into the room and I decided to do something really different. And it was mainly for me, but it had a surprising outcome, which was great. I went into the room, and this room is just, you know, really small. It's really just for the 8 finalists and somebody just to stand around in case there's a fight breaks out or something. I don't know. Never does. And so I went to the corner and I sat down in the corner on the ground. Now, you know, people, when it was in a room, it's not in a room anymore. It's in a corridor. Mm-hmm. They don't like to sit down because, you know, you're like boxing.
Limbering up.
And so, you know, as I sat down in the corner, it caused quite a lot of attention because I noticed, you know, people looking at me, these big, fat, fit athletes from Russia, etc., looking at me. And as I sat, I settled myself in the corner. I took out a book. It was Wilbur Smith. I'm not
Wilbur Smith. Well, it's on our lockdown list that you provided with us. So obviously it was a book that made a difference.
Yeah, and then I opened it up and I had the presence of mind to check it was the right way round and started to read. And over the top of my book, I could see the glance rate from the 7 other people in the room was too often and too frequent. And I could almost visualize the comic bubble coming out of their mouths saying, what's he doing? You know, doesn't he know what's going on? There's an Olympic final coming up and he's reading a book. Why is he reading a book? And at that point, I realized that all I had to do was tie my swimsuit and I'd won.
And you'd won. I mean, I think Channel 4 had it down as one of its top 50 greatest ever sporting moments because it was a dramatic finish. And I mean, in terms of that realization that you'd become a gold medal winner, I mean, you suddenly go to a different sort of like stratosphere, I guess, Duncan, in terms of how did you feel? I mean,
back to that, there was just a little thing I didn't have to, and then I'll catch up on that. But when I came up to breathe 25 meters from the end, I could feel everybody beside me, and I'd been injured and hadn't had proper training for some 18 weeks beforehand. And as I came up to breathe, all the visualization and emotionalization I'd done paid its dividend, along with all, of course, the hard work. Because I heard myself saying, if you don't do something right now, Duncan, you're not going to win. And this is the famous chimp on the shoulder that Peters wrote about, isn't it, a long time before. This was now a gorilla on my shoulder yelling. And all of the hard work came together. And I said to myself, and that's totally absurd.
So there was an inner monologue going on, even at this moment of incredible, physical activity.
And after that, I carried on going. Everybody fell away and I touched the end. Mm. And, I won by half a body length. So it was, by the time I got there, it was convincing, but it was all in the last 25 meters.
Yeah. That is an incredible story, and I suppose.
Well, the truth is, they let me win.
Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing about life is if you set it up, people like other people to succeed.
Yeah.
So they just let them succeed. Take the place. I'll stay at the back. I won't get eaten by it.
But I suppose you've got to want it, right? In terms of that 25 meters, you've got to push yourself somewhere. But I suppose this is why I think about Adam Peaty spoke about winning gold in Tokyo, and he finished up taking time out because he felt the pressure of it. He felt the whole overwhelming experience of it. I mean, is that how it? Was it like that for you? What was the sort of the sensation of being a winner and the aftermath?
Well, I had a plan, which I tend to have. I had a life plan from a fairly early age because being dyslexic and losing my hair, things had to be changed, and I found a way of changing the deck, and swimming was that. Mm. So it was all a progression of a life plan for me. And I'd put things in place, assuming that I was going to win, because that was the object of the exercise, wasn't it? I was incredibly fortunate to have gone to very good schools, which were challenged me in all sorts of different ways and it allowed me to grow. I'd had the American university experience, which was great. And I had a fantastic family background and some great brothers that support me. But one thing I will say is it sounds really bizarre, and my wife keeps on saying, don't say that, Duncan, it sounds, you mustn't say that. So I'm just going to risk
it. So you're going to say it.
It's almost as if living with success is harder than the success in its first place. And in a sense, that comes back to what Adam Peaty was saying, is that, be careful what you wish for. Mm. And I was fortunate in the fact that having lost my hair, I was stared at all the time. And, attention and everything is great when your ego's good. But if you're having, an off day and people start to, are in your face and you're not used to it, or you're shy or those other things, it can be really, really hard. And I often have argued, and thank goodness, sport has now become much better at it, that preparing people for after sport or after, success, because you've got, all these goals that center into one thing and, your whole life seems to revolve around that, and suddenly it stops and you have this, you lose all the support mechanisms you had with it, you lose all the excuses and you become common property as well. You've got to understand it and appreciate it. And then actually love it in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, but let's go back to, you talked about the things about self-confidence, about losing your hair, about being dyslexic. I mean, when you tell that story, it just feels, well, these are the challenges that I overcame. But I know, full well, because we've spoken about it, is that, dyslexia was something that made you feel like, I think you've talked about feeling like you were drowning in the classroom, and that there were confidence challenges. There were things that really did put you through your paces early in life. And I think it's an interesting question, because obviously, was it just the swimming that helped, that was the lifeline? Or were there other things that actually helped you come to terms with who you were, the challenges that you were going through, and turning what some might have perceived as weaknesses into your own version of superpowers?
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I feel sorry for people that are good at everything. Because how do you choose what to be good at?
Yeah.
I'm a great believer that we need contrast in our life to appreciate where we are and where we are and value what we have. And I got that contrast very young when I saw the difference between being good at something and not being so good at something. And that was in the classroom every day. So it came clear what I wasn't good at. So it then became, what could I be good at? The second part is that, you know, it's the old thing, none of us are islands, you know, very trite and everything, but it's absolutely true that, you know, people have to give us permission. And not only do they have to give us permission, they have to give us a lot of babysitting and support through the process of success. We need other people around us because we're a social being. And I was incredibly fortunate to have amazing people throughout my life, you know, from teachers, my parents, my coaches. They allowed me to grow and they allowed me the space to grow. They didn't suffocate me at all, but they supported me when I needed it at the right times. There's one particular what stands out. I went to Millfield School, and the head there who set up the school, the founder, was called a boss. Everybody called him the boss because he was. he set up the school. And he was a very different man. And I went to an interview with boss. And during the interview, and I was, you know, 13 years old, he spotted that I was dyslexic. And I was sent away. And dyslexia wasn't known then. He explained to what it was, which was, it was an eye-opener to me. And I went and got assessed there on the spot. I was then sent down to the swimming pool. And I was asked to do a medley. A 4x1 medley, that's you swim each of the strokes, by the only full-time professional coach in the whole country at the time, Paddy Garrett.
Yeah.
And so I got in and I couldn't swim butterfly properly. And just give you some kind of sense, Sharon Davis went to the Olympic Games in Montreal at the age of 12. And I was probably 12, I was probably 13 when this happened. And I couldn't even swim butterfly. And so I missed it out, and I landed at the end, wrong end of the pool as a consequence, because I didn't put anything in its place. So the coach, you know, now there was a standoff, eventually wandered down and said, you appear to be at the wrong end of the pool. Do you know why? So I tried to drown myself in embarrassment, got out. And we walked up towards boss's office and I was looking at the stitching in my shoes in absolute revulsion. And my parents were slumped and everything. And boss walks up and he takes one look at me and understands what's happened. So he then looks at the coach and said, Paddy, will he swim for the school? Now, he then looks back at me and he'd move very close to me, a little too close actually. So I'm looking up and he's looking down, and it's that eye to eye thing that's going on. He's looking into my soul. And in the background, Paddy Garrett says he'll swim for the school, the county, the district, and the country, and he'll probably go beyond that. The man changed my life because he gave me a chance to dream about the Olympic Games.
Well, it never ceases to amaze me, because obviously Millfield is a school that you and I have in common, that Paddy Garrett trained the Olympian Duncan Goodhue and the swimming no-hoper Michael Hayman. So it's a sort of like, it's a great, but I mean, there is a segue to that, which is, of course, you are big on the power of coaching in many things. I mean, you know, you've been involved with the Born to Coach initiative. I mean, the importance of people in terms of spotting your potential, bringing this out, is something you've spoken a lot about, not only because of your own experiences with people like Paddy Garrett, but Tony Roberts, the legend. Legendary Dave Haller, lots of people that have had an effect on your life. I suppose if you were looking at the question of what makes a great coach, you've spoken there about, I guess it's that kind of vision that somebody saw something in you in terms of that first step. But what if people think about, I want to get coaching in life, for business, for whatever it might be, what's the secret of a great coach?
I think the secret of a great coach is in between science and inspiration, isn't it? And that's why when you talk to coaches, they sometimes have a very jumbled philosophy, because what they have to do is they have to be a chameleon. They have to look at the person that they're coaching in front of them and understand that everybody they coach is going to have a different set of values, a different sense of purpose is important to them. And it's recognizing that and recognizing the science bit of how do I improve them, whether it's business or sport or whatever. Because, you know, we're all humans. We're only as good as our worst days. You know, we feel grungy and horrible some days, and we don't perform well as a consequence of that. So how do you get people past that? And then how do you get people past the fact that their biology is telling them to slow down because it feels a bit odd because they're ahead of everybody else. Mm. Whether it's business or whatever, coaches have a feeling of when not to say something as well as when to say something.
Mm. I'm so sorry that we're out of time. I'm sad about it because there's so much more I want to talk to you about. But I've got two thoughts about where I might go for my last question. But I think I'm going to come back to what we've been talking about, which is, I suppose, sporting legacy and how you see the future. Because when you were swimming, Duncan, I think it was, I think what made you exceptional was that you were one of a very distinct group of, I suppose, British winners at an elite level. Now that has exploded. You know, we spoke about Adam Peaty, whether it's Duncan Scott, James Guy, Ellie Simmons. I mean, the list is incredible, not only in swimming, but I suppose across almost every Olympic discipline. When you look about the future, I suppose a thought about your part in that story and how you see that story developing.
Well, I'm very fortunate. I helped somebody set up the National Lottery and lobby for a guy called Dennis Vaughan. So, I kind of feel that I had some involvement in that. But my focus in life has been more about the active world, about getting people to participate. And, I have a business called Limelight Sports where we've been doing that for 30 years. To me, sport, physical activity, it's not like buying a Mars bar and eating it, is it?
Yeah.
it's about going out there, and it's a whole journey. It's not about standing on the rostrum. It's about the whole journey in between there and what you're doing, how you're doing it, the relationships you have, how you learn and develop as an individual. And then, how you respond to the rostrum, whether it's, second, third, whatever, and how you move on from that and how that changes you. And that whole, really personal experience, how do you share it with other people? How does it become more important? I think through lockdown, we've all gone through, as I say, everything is the same, but everything's different almost, isn't it? Yeah. Because we've all been changed by it. And our value systems may have changed very slightly. And we certainly have a little bit more respect for our own health, etc. And so sport, I think, physical activity will really come back big time as we understand the importance of it. And, like the 1920s, a lot of money's been spent, a lot of things gone on. We will come out of this firing on all cylinders. So I'm very optimistic.
Well, listen, what a great place to leave it, Duncan. I mean, we started this conversation talking about you're only as good as your worst day. Well, thank you for giving us such a great listen. Duncan Coutu, thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers.
Thank you, Michael.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?
Just be